All right, here we go. Overdrive off and running. TSN 1050 on the TSN app, your home smart speaker. Soon to be up on TSN. Brian Hayes back in studio. Forget just being on the show. I'm back in studio. We've got Frankie Corrado in studio with me. Dave Feschuk is with us as well, the Toronto Star. We've got Brooke Henderson coming up here in a few minutes, boys. We don't do this very often. There are not too many guests where we will accept the 4:05 arrival time, but we will make an exception for Brooke.
As we should. The most decorated Canadian golfer.
Yes. All right, we might have to put her on the spot, Dave. I mean, I think we can probably pose that question to her. Are you comfortable with the idea that I think the majority of Canadian golf fans would consider her the greatest Canadian golfer of all time already?
I think the debate's over, guys.
Like, feels that way.
Once you win that second major, which she just did, it was pretty much the end of it. I mean, she already had more wins overall on tour than Mike Weir and George Knudsen. She had the one major. Once she got the second major, I just don't think there's an argument. Plus, she's in her early 20s. She's going to win many more.
Right.
And there really won't be an argument in another 5 or 10 years.
Yeah, it feels like that's almost a foregone conclusion. Like, what is Brooke Henderson going to continue to do the rest of her career? She's got, in golf terms, probably another 15 years of prime, maybe 20 years of golf prime.
Who knows?
20 years of prime.
And you know what's going to come with that, too? Experience, right? Like, understanding how to manage the course, how to manage the tournaments. Like, you can honestly say that her best days of golf could be ahead of her still.
Yeah, for sure. So Brooke will join us here in a moment. We're looking forward to that because I don't think we've ever caught up with Brooke Henderson. We've been tracking Brooke in her career for a long time. But so Brooke Henderson's going to call in here in just a few moments, and we'll ask her a number of things about her career, her upbringing, putting with the pin in, which I support when the ball goes in the hole. If it misses or whacks off the pin and fires somewhere else, although only bad golfers will do that.
Wait,
like Brooke Henderson is not wiring one off the middle of the pin.
So are you the guy that if it goes off the pin and doesn't go in, it's like, oh no, COVID rules, that putt counts.
No, that's done. But with the COVID rules, it was very beneficial. Like, how many phantom low rounds were out there from guys just wiring the ball off the pin?
Everyone's handicaps went down 2 points at least just from wire. And what about if you had the pool noodle? Like, even if it just skimmed that pool noodle, no, that's in the hole.
Yeah. Thankfully, they had the sense not to bring that to the tour, right? Like, they when the PGA Tour resumed, the LPGA Tour, they resumed as they are supposed to, with real golf rules, where it was the rest of the world that was playing pin-in rules. And
dude, the pool noodle, for me, I couldn't handle that one.
It was goofy.
That was goofy for me.
Yeah, it was very goofy.
Well, I told you, who's crying a tear for the guy that invented the pin caddy and sold about five million pin caddies to every golf course in North America, and especially in Canada, and now suddenly nobody wants a pin caddy anymore? Like,
nobody.
What's the deal?
No. Nobody. Everyone's happy to get, like, I'll grab the pin. Like, no one before ever wanted to grab the pin, put the pin back, just pure laziness. Like, it had nothing to do with anything else. And now it's like a fight over it just to prove that we're back to normal.
Yeah. And is there a little etiquette, too, as far as, like, making sure you put it back in enough times throughout the round? Like, if there's 18 holes, how many holes are you looking to be the guy that puts it back in? Like, you could get to the 14th or 15th hole and say, I think I've only done it once or twice today. I got to pull my weight a little bit.
It's a good question. Like, how much of that is just internal analysis and overthinking it?
Yeah.
You know, because I'll be honest with you, I never think of who else puts the pin in.
Right.
And how much they do. But I do think of it myself. Like, I better get a pin here. I've been sitting here. I'm not really contributing much.
You know, the last 9 holes, I didn't touch it. So someone else must have.
Yeah. Which means, am I the last one to putt out? Also not a good sign. You suck. Right?
Like,
if ever,
that's right.
If the rest of the group is like, all right, I'll hold the pin for you because you're still putting.
Yeah.
Then that is a bit of an issue as well.
Or maybe it's just that your playing partners, Hayes, are stingy buggers and they won't give you a putt. Like, where are the gimmies?
Yeah,
you're
valid.
Making me make 2 footers, then I got to put the pin in?
That,
like, what kind
valid
of a group is this?
So I'll tell you what, you realize, you know, when you play with a variety of people, like, if you have a regular game, then you get into a rhythm and everyone has an understanding of how the other guys play and what it's going to look like and the rules and regulations of that grouping. In other words, if I'm playing with my regular 3 buddies who I always play with, I know if it's inside 2 feet, it's a gimme. If it's not, it's not going to be, and I'm not going to lose sleep over that.
Yeah.
And believe me, they're not giving it to me. I'm not giving it to them. Like, it's accepted. We're
absolutely
all playing on the same plane here. When you start filtering through different friends. Yep. Like, if it's strangers you're playing with, then it's a very different atmosphere
you're
altogether.
Not, you might not play a money game at that point.
No, exactly. And you may say, hey, that's good for me, but, you know, if you want to putt everything out, it's your call. Like, yeah. You're out here doing your thing, I'm out here doing mine. I had an experience like that. I had a golf weekend this past weekend, and it dawned on me, I have a couple of friends who are actively, every time they're inside 5 feet, they are bartering for gimmies. Like, immediately snapping. Well, if you're going to give it to this guy, you got it. It's like, all right, take it then. Like, just shut up and pick up your ball. Like, it just, what it does is show a complete lack of confidence to make a putt.
Also, lack of character. Where's your discipline, man?
Lack of character, integrity, discipline.
I've played with guys where it's like, if it's a birdie putt, it's within 20 feet, and it's like a two putt. It's like a, but if you egregiously blow it by the hole, if you leave it really short, make the putt.
Yeah.
Like, if it's like a 5 foot or a 6 foot, you probably got to make it, and you probably should line it up too, because if your first putt was so bad, you're probably not going to make this next one.
Oh, absolutely. And like, I'm always curious how pros deal with practice rounds in gimmies.
Yeah.
Because you got to putt everything out, obviously, when you're on tour. But like, if you're Brooke Henderson and you're just playing a fun game with friends or family or whatever, is she putting everything out or is she taking gimmies? And is she handing out gimmies? Is Brooke very liberal with handing out gimmies?
She would give us gimmies within 4 feet?
4 feet is probably asking too much.
Yeah,
that's generous.
I think 2 feet. I'd be disappointed if I played with Brooke Henderson and I had a two-footer and she said,
I'm going to need to see it.
You have to putt that out.
Yeah.
But maybe, who knows? Why don't we get to the bottom of this? She's in town. She's up at Eagle's Nest, I believe you said, right, Graps? She is two-time major champion, Canadian pro golfer, as we know, Team RBC ambassador. Here is Brooke Henderson. How you doing, Brooke?
I'm doing great. How are you?
We're doing very well. Let's get to the important stuff here, because we were just talking about gimmies. When you're playing just a friendly round with people maybe you know or don't know, are you liberal with giving putts, or do you make people putt everything out?
Oh, no, I give a lot of putts, but if there's any money on the line, then then maybe not so much.
Yeah. What about yourself? Like, do you feel like you should putt everything out as a pro golfer, or have you ever been in a situation where you're looking at other people you're playing with thinking, you can't possibly expect I'm going to have to putt this out? Like, this should be a gimme. Are you expecting gimmies when you get on the green?
Yeah, I'm expecting gimmies, and I definitely take them.
Yeah, good. As you should. All right, good. Brooke Henderson,
she also doesn't need to stress out and grind over four-footers on, like, her practice rounds, right? Like, I gotta imagine if she's going out for a round of golf at her favorite track, Brooke, you're not looking to stress yourself out over those, right? You have enough of that during tournament weeks?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, yeah, that's good to hear. So you're basically like us. We want help whenever we can get help. That's good to know, even though you're a pro player. And we got into this conversation. We're talking about the pins, and you are one of the few pro players. You leave the pin in when you putt. Can you take us through your thought process on that? Why do you continue to adhere to that? Clearly it's been successful, but why do you putt with the pin in?
Yeah, I started putting with the pin in the beginning of this year, and I saw a bit of an improvement with my putting and just feeling a little bit more comfortable. So saves Britt a little bit of work, my caddy, and it also just seems to be a nice visual that I really like to have. You know, I think it's just maybe a little bit easier to pick aiming points and just to kind of have a little bit more of a target other than just the hole there. So just personal preference, but it seems to be working out okay.
Brooke, what are the benefits and advantages of the new putting grip you're using? You see you're going left-hand low. It's something new for you. You've had some success with it. What are you seeing with that?
Also new the last few months. Also Britt, my caddy's idea to try it out. And, yeah, it's been very successful. Two wins with it within the last few months. And it's just... It just kind of takes some things out of play, you know, it keeps you a little bit quieter and your stroke a little bit easier and better. So obviously it's been working well for me, and I try not to be too much of a technical player, keep things simple. I just love the way it feels, and, you know, it's been working.
Yeah, Brooke, when you made that birdie on the 18th at the Evian to seal your second major, I was wondering if you could take us through the journey of that day, because you know that you know the putter had been kind of you know really good for you on a lot of rounds, and early in the round it hadn't been. What were you feeling as you stood over that ball on 18 with that you know crucial putt staring in front of you?
Yeah, that day was a little bit, down and then got up, you know, started out front nine was not very good. Definitely not what I wanted going into that round, you know, with a couple shot lead. But, you know, Annika said that majors are won on the back nine on Sunday, and I just kind of reminded myself of that. And Britt, was telling me the same thing. And so going into that back nine, I just said, you know what, you have nine holes left, let's just do what we can. And I was able to make three birdies in my last five holes, including the one on 18 that sealed the victory for me. So, you know, just tried to, you know, stay in the moment, do what we could, make the best decision at the right time. And that putt on 18, I knew it was for the win, so I just wanted to give it a good run. And it was nice because reading the green and reading that putt, Britt saw exactly the same thing I did, and so that gave me a lot of confidence, and I just tried to step up with the new left-hand low and also the pin in the hole, yep, and was able to make it.
We're chatting with Brooke Henderson, and with that putt came a new Canadian bar that was set in terms of you winning your second career Grand Slam, and as a result, with all of the success you've had earlier in your career, including two majors, I should say, that has led to a lot of Canadians arguing or making the claim that you are now the greatest Canadian golfer of all time. Are you comfortable with that moniker? How do you respond to people suggesting you're the greatest player in Canadian history, man or woman?
Well, there's been so many talented players that have come before me, and I'm sure will come after me too. And it's just amazing to be in the same conversation as those great players and to be the winningest Canadian on either tour. You know, I'm very proud of that with 12 victories, and it was a big deal for me to get my eighth win a few years ago to tie that record, and you know, since to be able to continue to break it is pretty cool. So I'm definitely proud of that title. The greatest, yeah, I don't know about that totally, but I'm just trying to be the best I can all the time, and you know, hopefully there's lots more wins in the future.
Brooke, I mean, what does it feel like to have the whole country supporting you as a Canadian golfer on tour? You know, do a lot of players ask you about Canada, courses in Canada, what it feels like to have all that momentum behind you when you go into tournament weeks?
You know, to have CP Women's Open next week and to have the Brooke Brigade and to have all of the support from family and friends, you know, being so close to home, but also fans from all around the country and all around the world, you know, watching on TV and watching in person. It's a crazy week, but it's so much fun. And I just love having the opportunity to go out there and to try to compete for that trophy that I won in 2018. And, you know, just to be out there and have that opportunity really means a lot to me, and hopefully I can really soak it all in and use all the energy and adrenaline from the fans to put on a good show.
Brooke, obviously the big story of the year on the men's side of the game has been the controversy and the paydays being handed out to players on the LIV Golf Tour. I know Greg Norman has said that, you know, his tour would be open to a women's side, and I know the LPGA commissioner has, you know, said that they're, you know, they haven't ruled anything out. How do you see a competing tour and how it might work for the women's game?
Yeah, you know, it's all very interesting, and it's definitely caused a lot of conflicts, PGA versus LIV Tour, and, you know, I think the LPGA's kind of just trying to be prepared for everything. As you said, the commissioner, you know, she's trying to get a plan together and, you know, the player board and everything to see where the future might go, but as of right now, you know, nobody really knows, and I'm just excited and happy to be playing on the LPGA Tour.
We're chatting with Brooke Henderson, two-time major champ, Team RBC ambassador. Again, she'll be in Canada playing next week. And There's so many kids that look up to you, and obviously, you know, girls that look up to you, but there's also a lot of boys that look up to you. How important is that for you in terms of you making your mark on the young, you know, athletes in this country? And when you see young girls and young boys showing up and supporting you the way that they do, what does that mean to you, and how much do you cherish that idea?
Yeah, you know, I love looking out into the crowd and seeing young girls and boys out following at tour events. Just, you know, they love to be out there, and they're so happy to get an autograph or get a picture after the round. And that really means a lot to me, and I know it does to the other girls too. And we're just happy that they're enjoying the game, and we hope that they continue to try to be their very best at it and, you know, see where it takes them. I feel like they might say that they're inspiring or motivating us, but it works the other way too. You know, seeing them out there in the crowd, they inspire and motivate us to be a little bit better and, you know, to continue to push boundaries, especially on the women's side, and to continue to grow the game so that when they come out on tour, you know, the game's and the tour is in a better spot.
Brooke, who did you look up to as a young golfer and why?
So my sister, my older sister who caddies for me now, was a huge role model, and I was always trying to be exactly like her. So it's pretty special that we get to share this journey together now, you know, traveling around the world and playing in these events, and to have her by my side really means a lot. And also fellow Team RBC ambassador, Morgan Pressel. She was my favorite LPGA tour player growing up, and I actually got to meet her when I was really young, and, you know, that just meant the world to me. And I got to watch her play actually at the Ottawa Hunt when the Canadian Open was there a long time ago, and I was still pretty young, and she's just been great. And so now to be her friend and to be on Team RBC with her, it's pretty special.
Brooke, Golf Canada has been talking about some really ambitious goals in terms of getting more Canadian men and women onto the various tours. I think the number they're looking at is 30 PGA Tour and LPGA Tour players combined by the year 2032. How do you see that? And you know, how realistic is it to think that we could get that many players on both tours?
I know Golf Canada is really pushing hard, and with the support of RBC, you know, they're really trying to grow the game as much as they can and try to give as much access and as many opportunities as they can to those players coming up through the ranks, you know, the best coaches and the best tournaments to go compete at. And they're really trying to do everything that they can to make sure that the game continues to grow here in Canada and that more players come out on tour. So I think that's great. And I feel like, you know, sometimes there's a bunch of us out there, and other years, you know, there's not as many. But I think going forward, it's only going to grow and get better. And it'll be pretty cool to have a lot of Maple Leafs, you know, being represented out on tour.
With Brooke Henderson, you mentioned you're a Team RBC ambassador. We see your commercials all the time. How would you grade your acting skills?
Oh, not very good, but they make me look all right, and that's all that matters.
Yeah, absolutely. It's working for you for sure, and obviously your game is dialed in, so we look forward to seeing what you have next weekend in Ottawa and throughout the rest of the season and moving forward. And we're huge supporters of yours, Brooke, so we really appreciate you finding time for us, and we'll have to do this again down the road. Thank you for this.
Thank you so much.
There is Brooke Henderson, Canadian pro golfer, two-time major champion, and as we mentioned, Team RBC ambassador.
Maybe Grappler, save her number, see if she can help us out with our snap hooks.
You know what? It's funny because I was going to bring that up. Like, in retrospect, when you talk about the major that she won on 18, she snap-hooked her drive off
right.
the tee, and it hit the trees and actually got a very advantageous drop to the point where she could lay up, throw a dart, hit a putt for birdie, and win the tournament. And, like, what was going through her head when she was leaving the tee box
yeah.
compared to after making the putt and looking back, and you probably laugh at the yeah. fact that you just did that. Because she was driving the ball borderline perfectly throughout that weekend.
And that's her bread and butter, right?
Yeah, like, bombs the ball at the tee. Yeah. And finds fairways and picks up her tee quickly and moves on with her life. And on 18, it was a snap hook.
Yeah.
And she got away with it.
Do you think if we asked her and she was, like, walking us through it, we would just, like, take off the headset and just kind of work on it here? A little weight shift and, you know, getting your hands again. Like, I would. I would just be here right now doing that.
We all could use the help.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. But, yeah, I mean, listen, she's a great player.
I think she's one of those athletes, though, guys, that, you know, she can't, you know, she just does it, right? She's swung like that. She's bombed it since she started swinging it, right, as a young girl. I don't think she needed a ton of coaching, and I don't think she, you know, needs a ton of coaching now. And I'm not sure she really can. It's like kind of like Gretzky, you know.
Just
like,
hit it better.
Not the
how
greatest
about
coach, because why can't you do it like I did it? Just watch this tape. This is how you do it.
Stop chopping it up 2 to 3 times a week and just hit it better. There's your answer.
Yeah, it's tough to relate. Tough to relate. I mean, that's the truth. Like, there's a reason they're pros and we're stiffs. You know?
Yeah.
So, anyway, we appreciate Brooke Henderson finding some time for us. We'll get into the Jays. We'll get into this LeBron James signing. Fernando Tatis Jr. I missed out on that topic. We'll get into that as well. Dave Feshtrick of the Stars here. Frankie Corrado, I'm Brian Hayes. Overdrive continues. TSN 1050 and on the TSN app. All right, Brandon Bean, the GM of the Buffalo Bills, will join us a little bit later this afternoon. 3 weeks tomorrow night. Bills at Rams. I was looking it up because I knew there would be a line on it. And I went into it. Sometimes I will try to come up with what I think the line will be before I actually see it.
Yeah.
And I figured the Rams would be favored. And they are not.
Really?
The Bills are a 2.5-point favorite as of right now.
And that's on the road for the Bills?
That's at L.A.
Wow.
So you're at L.A. opening night. There'll be a million Bills fans because they travel so well. And L.A.'s, you know, who knows who's going to show up for the Rams.
Yeah.
I think partially that has to do with Stafford, and is it a shoulder I think he's dealing with? Like, he is,
right.
He's been banged up, but he'll play. He plays every week.
Yeah.
And I think the Bills getting love, man. The Bills
they are
getting a lot of love, and deservedly so.
I wonder if they're going to, like, how they're going to deal with the pressure now, because now it's expected. It's expected from Josh Allen. It's expected from the whole team. Pretty imperative they get off to a good start. You know, we're seeing it now a little bit with the Jays, right? Mm-hmm. Where the expectations were really, really high, and it hasn't come to fruition, and now it's struggle city.
And it can spiral on you, right? Like, it's there's a weird fork in the road with high expectations.
Yeah.
Where if you can ride that wave all the way to a magical season.
You're just a juggernaut.
Juggernaut, and you have energy behind you, and everyone loves you, and everyone supports you. But if you have built up the expectations, even if it's not like the players directly doing it, it's just the media more than anything else.
That's all it is. We need stuff to talk about.
Or Vegas saying, hey, this is what is supposed to happen. Or possibly the GM and coach coming out, you know, the owner coming out and saying, we believe in our team. We're going to do this, that, or the other. If it doesn't work out, you get more vitriol directed towards you.
Yep.
Than any other scenario. And I think the Blue Jays are dealing with it right now. The Jays are still in a playoff spot. Now, they are holding up for dear life.
Yeah.
For dear life. And they are in a swoon right now, man. They are playing bad baseball fundamentally. They're not showing up in really any capacity.
Errors, man. Errors galore.
Lots of errors. Bo Bichette is at the forefront of this. Like, he is costing them at the plate, but also in the field. He's 0-2 in the count, it seems like, every time he's up to the plate.
Yeah.
Fielding errors, throwing errors. It's an issue for Bo. And it's spiraling out of control. Yet they're still in a playoff spot, and they're trying to let the world know that.
Yes.
Like, we're still in a playoff spot. We're trying to hold on for dear life. But when you come into a season where everyone's saying you're going to win 100 games and probably run away with the East and be a favorite to win the World Series, and you're just holding on in the middle of August, you're not going to get a lot of love.
No.
Or support.
Especially when you're
2-8. That's the way
it goes. 2-8 in your last 10, right? Like, and this is not the time of year. You can say you can have a little bit of a lull. You can play some 500 ball. You'll get away with that. But 2-8 in your last 10 in a division where Baltimore, like the Orioles are on your tail now.
Well, and prior to that, you fired your manager because you were 1-9 leading into that.
Exactly. And now where are you at?
And you fired your manager, guys, because you insisted that you were more talented than you were showing, and that you could be more aggressive on the base paths than in other areas of the game, and there was better ahead, and we haven't seen any of that better. In fact, we've seen a lot of the same, and a lot of the same stuff that was coming out of Charlie Montoya's mouth about how, hey, good things are around the corner, this team is way better than we're showing. The exact same things are coming out of John Schneider's mouth now, you know, all these weeks later, and the record's getting worse.
Well, I can tell where this is going with Schneider, because if this falls apart, if it doesn't get back on the rails, I don't believe it'll be his fault, but it will be proven that it wasn't Montoyo's fault. What is going to happen is the heat will go on the players and the front office.
Yeah.
That's where the heat is going. Generally, in a town like Toronto, the front office, I think, gets a disproportionate amount of attention. The players can get let off the hook.
Yep.
And we see it with the Leafs. We see it with the Raptors. The Leafs are an example. The Leafs are the ones playing. They're on the ice. They can't close. And then Dubas gets grilled. Does Dubas deserve some of that? Of course he does. But he doesn't play. Atkins and Shapiro don't play. The players are the ones that are not getting it done. But what will happen here is if the Jays cannot, you know, figure this out, and they still have a lot of time to do so, and they're in a race right now, what will be asked of Ross Atkins is, how did you expect to go from a manager who lacked experience to a manager who has even less experience,
right,
being the guy that was going to trigger some sort of massive response?
Yeah.
Because Schneider, by all accounts, was a manager in waiting. They've been grooming him. He had a louder voice than is usually the way of, you know, a bench coach. But he has no major league experience.
Right. And I'm all for aggressiveness. I think that was the word that they used a lot when Schneider came in. The team's going to be more aggressive. But I also still think you need to be smart, man. Like, work a count every once in a while. It's two on, two out, two strikes. You're swinging at the first thing you see. You're striking out. You're grounding out. Like, I think there's a little more, I don't know. There's a fine line between patience and aggressiveness, and finding where that line is as far as, you know, being more efficient. And right now it feels like, you know, they're trying to hit and run a lot, and you're not connecting on it. You're getting thrown out. Like, you know, where's a little bit of the game management? Where's that? You hit the nail on the head. It's experience, right? Like, where, if you had someone who maybe has a little more experience, maybe they could, you know, put that on their team. But I also think too, like, for the manager, how do you account for Berríos not pitching well? How do you account for Kikuchi not pitching well? How do you account for Springer being injured all season long? Like, these are things that are out of your control if you're the manager.
Absolutely.
As well.
They're out of your control, but, you know, it's interesting how, in a lot of ways, you talk about how this town sometimes lets players off the hook. And we do. Like, you're right. The disproportionate amount of blame for what the Leafs have gone through has not gone on John Tavares and Auston Matthews and Mitch Marner and William Nylander for not delivering in game sixes, in game seven, in elimination games, in clinchers. It's gone on, you know, Kyle Dubas for the way he's managed contracts and the way he's managed the salary cap and the way he hasn't put goaltending as a priority. In this case, sometimes you wonder if, you know, maybe the idea that this team, you know, we heard it from Charlie Montoya, we're hearing it now, the idea that, hey, our talent will get us through, maybe they got to rely less on talent and more on the details of the craft. Because it seems as though the details of the craft, because they've got talent, oh, we don't need to pay attention to the fundamentals.
Right.
And we see it again and again. There's just a sloppiness to this team. There's an inattention to detail that continues to bite it. And maybe you can get away with it when you're swinging a hot bat. But right now they're not, and it's showing in glaring ways.
Yeah, and it's no longer early. It has not been early for quite some time.
No.
Like, to expect Berríos just to snap out of it,
yeah,
I think is foolish. And
exactly.
Like, Bichette's an example of that. He was hitting seventh yesterday. He's hitting sixth in the lineup today because Springer's out of the lineup. That's long overdue. He is hitting like someone who should be seventh in your lineup.
Yep.
He's not deserving of just being handed the cleanup spot or hitting second or wherever he has been throughout his career here. He is not performing. So, you know, that's a combination of the analytics telling you that, but also the old school, I'm just watching it and it's not working.
Yeah.
So I got to jab them and send a message.
And with the Jays team now, like, where's the potential for them? Because they're clearly not World Series contenders. Are they going to be in the wild card spot? Like, what is the ceiling for this team at this point in the season? Because they're not playing like a team that is going to, you know, walk their way into the playoffs. So they're going to have to scratch and claw from now on in to make the playoffs.
Yeah, they are. And I mean, the thing that they have going for them, which I guess is only something if you actually punch your ticket and make it, is the Yankees are free-falling themselves. Like, as of now, it looks like there's Houston, who is just a talented, deep, very good ball club, top to bottom. And the Yankees have been in a downward spiral for a long time.
Yeah.
We're going on in 2 months now. Like, the Yankees are not the team that was projected to win 110 games.
They got pitching problems, too.
They got a lot of problems.
Yeah.
So the Yankees stink right now. The Yankees are not that good. Cleveland's, you know, they've been better recently, but who cares about... Cleveland is not a stacked lineup.
No.
Whoever wins the Central is not going to scare you. That's really what you have going for you. That's the spin.
Yeah, and even
get
Tampa,
it together, get in, and there aren't that many great teams in the American League.
That's the thing, man. Like, if you can figure it out, you're going to do yourself a lot of favors, because even Tampa's just playing around 500 ball.
Yeah, they're just plugging along.
You know, the only team that's really playing well in the AL East is Baltimore. They're crushing it.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are.
But, you know, maybe the saving grace of this year, though, guys, look, if this year, you're right, there's all kinds of reasons for optimism. It's not an overwhelming situation. You can still easily get in thanks to the expanded format. And who knows what happens once you're in. You only needed a couple of pitchers, and if you start getting hot at the right moment, it could happen. But maybe the saving grace of this year, though, guys, is that, you know, the Blue Jays have waited to pay their guys, right? They've waited to play Vladdy, still haven't paid him. They've waited to play Bo Bichette, still haven't paid him. And maybe a down year, because if you would have paid Vladdy off last year's, you know, MVP caliber year, and then he has a swoon. This isn't really a swoon, but it's obviously not up to the caliber he established last year. Maybe the fact that they've waited a little bit to pay these guys, and who knows all the reasons why, it will work out in their favor. Because suddenly they got both these guys have who are going to get real money. I'm not going to say they're not going to get paid. They're going to get real money. But then you'll factor in their averages are going to be down thanks to a down year. And maybe you get him cheaper in the end, and maybe you get him a little more humble in the end, and you don't, you know, you're not looking at a Fernando Tatis Jr. contract, $330 million over 14 years, and you can't trust the guy.
Yeah. I think Vladdy is separate, because as much as he's having a down year compared to last year, his numbers are still going to be impressive, you know, relative to the rest of the league by the end of the season. Bichette has a very different reputation in the city today compared to where it was this time last year. Like, it is not even close. You know, I would say Teoscar Hernandez, who is up after next year, he is certainly not having a platform season the way he has in the past couple of years when he's been healthy. The issue, and I agree with what you're saying, Dave, the problem with the economics of this club moving into the offseason, and we are definitely putting the cart before the horse, is if you start to talk money, how can Ross Atkins, now that we are going to bring up the GM, and I think appropriately critique what he's all about and what he's done here, how do you go to ownership and say, I need more money, when you swung and missed on Kikuchi? That's a disaster.
Yeah,
that's an absolute disaster. He's
gross
done.
Gross overpayment.
He's done. Like, I'm not sure he starts again for this club unless they are two or three other arms down and it's mandatory because of injury purposes. So that is, what, $10 million next, $10 million the year after that. This year you're paying him $16 million to crush you.
Yeah.
It's basically $36 million down the drain. Ryu is done. Now, insurance can pick that up, but still, that was a lot of money where you got basically 12 or 13 starts in a COVID year out of $80 million. George Springer is a Band-Aid right now. That's what
Right from the get-go.
Right from the get-go. You paid him a fortune.
Yeah.
Jose Barrios is in year one of a seven-year deal at $130 million. He's a mess.
Yeah, he doesn't inspire a lot of confidence on the mound right now.
Like, I know fans don't want to hear it, but it is business. And Shapiro and Atkins have to go into that board after the season and explain. Forget saying, hey, we want this money for this guy. If I'm on that board, I'm saying explain Kikuchi, Barrios, Springer, Ryu. Those are the four biggest deals of the last 2 years.
The Springer one's easy to explain. Like, the guy is a World Series champ. He brings a lot of pedigree. He's a big leader in the clubhouse. It's been unfortunate that he's been hurt right from day one. That's out of his control. Like, that's, for me, that's an assertive move. Like, that's the kind of alpha that I want to bring into that clubhouse. Mm-hmm. The other one, the Kikuchi one,
that's just a miss.
You ask all the questions you want on that one.
Yes.
And then even for Barrios.
This is such a falling of grace. It's
crazy.
Almost impossible to understand. Like, he has been a relatively consistent high-end pitcher for 5 years coming into the season. So that one is difficult to explain, and you are being reasonable, Frankie, but if you're a bean counter, reason doesn't necessarily factor in.
Right.
Like, you look at Springer and you say, I understand everything you were thinking.
Yeah.
We all celebrated that, but how can you tell me I am going to get full investment, you know, or full value on my investment the rest of the way when this guy's injured this much the first 2 years? What's he going to be the next three?
And I also think the Springer one and the Ryu one are two different things, because I didn't think Ryu was going to come in and be the savior here in this rotation anyways, but that was a lot of money that they threw at him, and his injury trouble is different than Springer's.
Right, but it's like everything else, guys. When you're an investor in the stock market or you're an investor in players, you don't get judged on your theory and the sound logic you use to make the investment. You get judged on your portfolio and how it looks year over year, right? And right now, Ross Atkins' investment portfolio has a lot of stinkers in it. And you're right, Hayes. Like, when you're going to go and ask for more money, and it's going to be a lot of money, to bet on more players, I think there's going to be some eyebrows raised at those meetings where we're like, well, can we trust this guy to lay our bets for us? Or, you know, is this something we need to look further into? Because right now, Ross Atkins' record as a bettor, as an investor, whatever you want to call it, is dismal.
Well, those ones, again, it's a bad scene. Like, in terms of the investment in Kikuchi in particular, that's a laughing stock contract.
Yeah.
Like, that's one where there is no explanation how he got 3 years of 36
million. Other GMs are just sitting around in a group chat laughing about that one?
Well, it's a dodged bullet, the rest of the league. We're like, thankfully, that's not on my plate.
That's not me. I'm not that guy.
Yeah.
You know, but that one's 36 million, and you can possibly, you know, you probably are going to just have to designate him for assignment, but maybe you can flip him and eat like 90% of it and save some money. Barrios is a whole different story.
That's a monster.
Like, Barrios is a monster, and if there is something going on with him that is going to lead him down a like Ricky Romero road, and I know no one wants to hear that, but if it ever got to that point, man, that's one that cost people jobs.
Yeah,
that's one that is crushing because they need him. They need him to perform.
That's the one, like, as an athlete, when you look at that and you see a guy fall from grace like that, you have so many questions as far as, like, physical, mental, like, what's going on in your life, man? Because everyone who's played a sport has experienced ups and downs. And, you know, there's times where you're going to have the downs, but you have confidence that it's going to come back around for you. You're going to pick up some kind of momentum. You'll get in that flow state, but it doesn't seem like this guy's, or every time he does, it's so short-lived, and then it's right back down into the dumpster for this guy. Well, I feel bad for him. I really do.
Look at last week, where he gets rained out on the road, and everyone's celebrating it, because that means he can come home and pitch.
Yeah.
And he gives up eight earned runs at home against Baltimore.
You
never know what's going to happen, though, when you give guys money, right? You know, I've talked to so many GMs about this over the years, and now that the money's getting bigger and bigger, like, you don't know if you can trust a guy when you give him the money. And maybe it's not malicious that these guys aren't performing. They're not saying, I got my money, screw you, I don't need to perform. We know they want to perform.
Yeah.
But, you know, things change when you get life-changing money. Things change when you get your biggest payday of your life. Maybe it doesn't change for everybody, and maybe there's guys who are level-headed enough to just keep being who they are, and certainly we have examples of that. But, look, I mean, the Tatis deal in San Diego is a great example. What a mess. The minute they gave him the 323, or whatever it was, 330, you know, they haven't been able to trust him. He's in motorcycle accidents, plural. He's taking, you know, illegal steroids, allegedly for ringworm, according to his father. But, you know, enough to set up the detectors on the PED testing unit that give him an 80-game suspension. I mean, what do you say to that? You give the guy everything, and he gives you back Butkus.
Well, just because we have journalistic integrity, I believe the ringworm was from Junior. The haircut that was butchered was from Senior. Right.
Well, he got the ringworm from the haircut.
Senior saying that Junior got a bad haircut and had to take this spray, and that's what triggered. Hey, guy, you make a lot of money. Maybe don't go to, like, I don't want to degrade any haircut places here, but don't go to Mario the Butcher for your haircut. You can afford like a nice place, maybe, where they actually clean the utensils.
Well, it's like they're not. I can't figure out if they're trying too hard or they're not even trying for these explanations because. No. Like, I lean towards the latter. Like, it's lazy, but they think they're smart. Like, well, we got to come up with something. We'll come up with ringworm based on a butchered haircut. Like, no one buys it. No one believes it. He took PEDs. They caught him. He got clipped. He's done for the year.
Yeah.
And now, like, I guess you'd argue the Juan Soto deal is that much more important.
Yeah.
But you made that deal in San Diego with the expectation Tatis Jr. was a week and a half away from returning.
Here's how dumb
right.
this is.
It's like, crazy.
Here's how dumb it is. As a player in any sport, you have so many meetings at the start of the season about what you can take and what you can't take. You get the pamphlet, you get the list. They say talk to the trainers, talk to the doctor. Don't take anything unless it has a certain stamp on it. It's NSF. Okay. If you take anything with that stamp, you can guarantee you will not test positive. Why on God's green earth would you take anything as an athlete without talking to all these people or looking over the pamphlet? Like, it's just, it's crazy.
It's because he knew what he was taking.
Exactly.
Or he got paid so much money he didn't care what he was taking.
That's so lazy.
Of course it is. Like, if you're in San Diego, you have to be absolutely cursing this guy's name. And they offered him, they gave him $340 million or whatever. He had played less than a full season of baseball. He had not played a full collective 162 games in baseball.
And the guys in the clubhouse...
And they offered him that money.
The guys in the clubhouse are fed up with it. Eh?
You have to be.
They don't care. Like, they were saying
the other day... He's like, proving he's just a kid.
Yeah, he got
too much money.
We're good here with who we got in this clubhouse, and we'll move on. Like, they have no time for this nonsense.
Well, and you got to think the agents are also thinking, man, we're fighting so hard to get paid.
Right.
We're fighting for everyone to get the money, but... The owners are going to say, this is exactly why we don't pay kids.
Yep.
This is why we went forever not paying the 22-year-old and the 23-year-old. We'll pay the 30-year-old because we know what that guy's about. We got a better idea of it. And Tatis Jr., that's going to cause problems. It's going to cause problems. And if you're in San Diego, you got to be absolutely furious. And they're holding on for dear life themselves.
Yeah.
Wild card or bust for San Diego. Speaking of investments and someone who is well into his 30s, and I think we got a pretty good idea of what this guy's all about, LeBron James has got a new deal. He's got an extension in L.A. We'll tell you about it, the possible ripple effect that might come with it. We'll do that next. So the NBA has slowly been releasing their schedule, what feels like for about 2 months. Like, didn't we know about the Christmas games a long time ago, and a lot of marquee matches are out? But anyway, the full reveal came out today. And it was completely overshadowed by the LeBron James news because it broke literally within minutes of the whole schedule being released that LeBron has agreed to a 2-year, $97.1 million contract extension with the Lakers, which includes a player option for the 24-25 season. He is entering his final year right now, only going to make $44.5 million this year.
Yeah.
So I don't know how LeBron will survive off that, but he's going to have to make it work. And then he gets a $97 million extension. So he's staying in L.A., and this says a couple of things. One, this is more about his off-the-court business than anything else. The second he went to L.A., he told the world he'd like to win a championship, which he did down in the bubble.
He did.
He got it. Yes, was it the strangest championship in league history? Of course. But it counts. It's a ring. It was a win semi-parade during COVID in L.A. That counts. But when he showed up in L.A. and signed a 4-year deal, and now he's signing this extension before his final season, he is telling the world that he is no longer so ambitious to win, that it's more about lifestyle. It's more about family. It's more about L.A. It's more about what's going on off the court, because he really began, he was the beacon of hope for player empowerment and keeping the owners and the GMs feet to the fire in terms of what you're doing to help me win. And the way he would do that is he'd sign 1-year deals.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He's not even trying like that. In L.A., he's just like, I'm here. I'm sticking around. Yeah. We suck. It doesn't matter. It's a different LeBron. It's a different approach than in his prime. That's how I see it.
You hit on something there. It's about show business for sure, Hayes. And Frankie, it's about lifestyle, because why wouldn't you want to live in Southern California when you got all the money in the world? But it's also about family. And this is an interesting deal on another level, because he's got the 2 guaranteed years beyond this one, and then he's got a 3rd-year player option on this extension that would kick in 2024-25. And what's the significance of that year, 2024? Well, it happens to be the draft year of one Bronny James.
Ooh, and Bronny's dunking
LeBron
like crazy
would have some
right
leverage
now
on the Lakers to say, hey, I'll play next year on my player option. If you draft a certain kid that is a progeny of mine, born in 2004, who will be draft eligible, and he's, you know, stated he wants to be the Gordie Howe of basketball and play with his son.
Well, he invests enough in himself to be that, because, man, for the amount of money he makes, he invests a lot back into himself to keep him on the court. I have a lot of respect for him in that regard, but as far as him staying in LA too, like, listen, he's a businessman, not a businessman. You know what I mean? Like, that, he's churning out money.
Oh, and it's a great thing for the NBA that he's likely playing at least three more years.
Yeah.
Like, he is the epitome of content. He has more following than the NBA put together, like, in terms of Instagram, social media. He is synonymous with the sport as much as the NBA is synonymous with him.
Yeah, he's bigger. He's bigger than the league.
You need him playing. You want him playing, and especially if he's in LA, and ideally if you're Adam Silver and the TV partners and the media partners, you want the Lakers to be competitive. I don't think that's going to happen this year, but LeBron's also chasing history in terms of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. He's 1,326 points away from taking over Kareem for the most points in NBA history. I was looking at the schedule. Game 67 of the season, I believe, for the Lakers. The Raptors in L.A. That's probably around the time he'd be looking to pass it.
Yeah.
That'd be interesting. We'll get into that more coming up in the next hour. Jonathan Papelbon will join us. And Brandon Bean, GM of the Bills, still to come as well. Overdrive continues. TSN 1050 and on the TSN app.